Chasing ghosts. Let's do it. Mark Hartzman back with us. We're going to be talking about the supernatural in a moment and the strange on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Mark Hartzman back with us. Mark's passion for the unusual started with Ripley's Believe It or Not, as a lot of us did, in the annual Guinness World Record books during his youth. In addition to his own books about ghosts, Mars, Oliver Cromwell's embalmed head, weird things on eBay and the sideshow performers and unorthodox messages from God, Mark has written for Mental Floss, The Huffington Post, AOL Weird News, AllThat'sInteresting.com, The Morbid Anatomy Online Journal, and Bizarre Magazine. He has discussed oddities on CNN, MSNBC. He's been on our program, Ripley's Radio, and the Travel Channel's Mysteries at the Museum. You're all over the place, Mark. Welcome back.
Thanks, George. It's good to be back.
How you doing? Everything good?
Yeah, doing well. Keeping busy.
Great.
How are you?
And Chasing Ghosts just came out today, didn't it?
Yes. Today was the launch day. Very exciting.
How about that for timing? Perfect. We'll get into this and some of the other things. So let's go back to the moment you were a youth. I was like you. Ripley's Believe It or Not that I would see in the newspaper and in the comic sections would just always capture my attention. Guinness World Records. I loved all of that. It captured you too, didn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I used to love watching the show when Jack Palance was the host, and just seeing this video of just amazing, remarkable people. And with the Guinness Book, I mean, I really loved the Guinness books. They were those little short black and white thick books back then, and I just loved that first section, the first 20 pages. I think it was called The Human Body, was chapter one. And that's where you just had all these anomalies. And my favorite of the anomalies was the world's tallest man, which was Robert Wadlow.
That's right. Out of Alton, Illinois.
Yes, exactly. He was just, I mean, every year they'd have different images, like a different photo and different stats, So I get, pre-internet, so you get a little bit of extra information. And I just couldn't believe how huge this man was. I mean, just towering above everyone else. I mean, when he was like five, he was bigger than his dad.
And when he died, didn't they bury him in a piano?
Yeah, he had a massive coffin case. Yeah. And the crazy thing is, when he died, he was only 22 years old.
Oh, my
gosh. He was still growing. So it's one thing I find just, I mean, it's upsetting because the man would have been 9 feet tall. I mean, it's upsetting because he was 22. But as someone who's just fascinated by the numbers around it, I mean, to reach 9 feet tall would have just been extraordinary. And he was taken down by a blister on his toe.
Oh, my gosh.
Things. And he got infected under a leg brace. And by the time he was treated, he had a 106-degree fever, and that ended his life.
So once you got into all these stories as a youth, you never forgot them, did you?
No. These things really stayed with me. I also watched The Elephant Man, probably the too young of an age, the David Lynch film. And that really stayed with me.
That was a classic.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just what an amazing story Joseph Merrick is. So, yeah, these things stayed with me. And then I just pursued, writing about different unusual people and started meeting different people within the sideshow world. And that really got me going.
Did you ever think you would do this as a career?
I always wanted to be just, a full-time writer. I mean, my day job is in advertising, so I do write for advertising, but in terms of just writing books and about things I'm more passionate about, I mean, that's the goal.
This is your notoriety. This is what you're known for, these things.
Yeah, I'm thrilled that I'm still doing it and enjoying it.
I'm going to knock out a few of the titles of your books just so folks will get an idea of what you've done. Found on eBay, 101 genuinely bizarre items from the world's online yard sale. American Sideshow, an encyclopedia of history's most wondrous and curiously strange performers. The Embalmed Head of Oliver Cromwell, a memoir. The Big Book of Mars, from ancient Egypt to the Martian, a deep dive into our obsession with the red planet, and the one that just came out today, Chasing Ghosts, which we're going to get into too. But all of these works that you've done are all incredibly interesting and bizarre, aren't they?
Yeah, that's my theme. Trying to find that's the consistent thread. Different and bizarre in all different kinds of ways.
And we've got a couple websites for you, Weird Historian and MarkHartzmanBooks.com as well.
Yes.
linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Well, let's spend a little time here talking about Chasing Ghosts, and maybe if we have some time tonight, we'll talk about some of your other works. We'll take calls next hour from our group of incredible folks who are very interested in what you do. Tell me about the title, Chasing Ghosts.
Yeah, well, the subtitle to it is A Tour of Our Fascination with Spirits and the Supernatural. So the thought of chasing ghosts is just about how we've, you know, since humanity's been around, we've been looking and wondering about what there is, you know, in the afterlife. Is there an afterlife? Does consciousness survive? Can we communicate with the dead if the dead do survive? Can we use technology to capture ghosts? So Chasing Ghosts kind of captured the different ways that we have either thought about death, tried to communicate, or capture evidence of an afterlife.
Would you call the ghost world, the spirit world, supernatural or natural?
You know, that's a good question. I feel like the term supernatural is a pretty broad term. You know, it can be kind of defined in different ways. I guess I would call it supernatural, maybe only because, you know, there's no particular proof or evidence. You know, people believe different things, and there's certainly evidence that can point one way or the other. It's definitely a subjective thing. One thing I like about the book is I present different cases and different ways that you could maybe explain things away, or certain cases that are really difficult to explain, and leave it up to the reader to kind of take the evidence presented on both sides and decide what they want to believe.
Mark, I don't think I've seen a poll where people have been polled about their belief about the supernatural, the spirit world, whether they think it exists or not. But if you polled 100 people, what do you think the percent would be, those who believe in an afterlife?
Well, I did actually cite a poll in the book from 2019 from a site called YouGov, and it says about 45% of people believe in ghosts.
That's all? I would have thought it would have been higher.
I thought that was a pretty good percent. I mean, it's almost half of people believe in it.
Now, if you polled this audience, it would be 85%.
Yes, it would skew higher.
Yeah, much, much higher indeed. Indeed. In your opinion, what are ghosts?
So that's also a good question. And, you know, going into this book, and I talked about this in my introduction, I would have said I've never seen a ghost. And then as I talked to different parapsychologists and paranormal investigators, you start to kind of rethink certain experiences and redefine what a ghost is. I think a lot of people think that a ghost is something that you will see in front of you, some sort of apparition, you know, like you'd see it in a movie. I mean, we're all kind of, you know, our imaginations are sort of, to some degree, created by what we've seen in pop culture, whether it's representations in movies and, you know, television and books, whatever it might be. So you think of it as a thing that you see in front of you. But it could also just be something that's in your mind's eye or received through different senses. For example, you might have, say, five people in a particular place where a spirit might be coming through and trying to make contact mm-hmm. with people. And everyone might receive that spirit in a different way. Someone might see something through their mind's eye, a representation of that person. Someone might smell something. It could be a completely olfactory sensation. Someone might hear something. Someone might feel nothing at all and think that the rest of the people are just completely nuts. So it can be different experiences. I think what it is some kind of connection from the dead to the living in one way or the other.
Interesting take. What do you think of mediums? We know what Harry Houdini thought.
Yeah, and I definitely get into some of the Houdini stories. And one thing that I'll say about Houdini is, yes, he was very much into exposing the frauds, but he was open to the idea of this being possible. Right. He just hadn't found anyone he believed was legitimate.
Well, he was obsessed with finding the spirit of his mother, wasn't he?
Yes. And, of course, when, you know, he famously had a friendship that was kind of strained with Arthur Conan Doyle, when Conan Doyle's wife, Lady Doyle, who was a medium, said to have made a connection with Houdini's mother and wrote like 15 pages of messaging from his mother at a seance. And Houdini said, "That's not my mom. You know, first of all, she didn't speak English. You know, the whole thing was in English." She's like, "There's no way." And Doyle wasn't too fond of that reaction. But I think that, you know, I have a lot of stories about different mediums in the book. And for the most part, there were ways that people would explain what they were doing. But there are some cases where it still really makes you wonder, like, okay, well, how is that possible? So, the question remains, I mean, are some of these mediums genuine? And it seems like there very well could be some who have legitimate powers.
Sure.
Some of the things just seem too hard to explain. I mean, yes, there are ways that things could be done, but in some cases, it's just a little bit, it's hard to imagine how something like that could have been faked.
Were most mediums in the earlier days women or men?
Most, I mean, there were definitely men, but there was a majority of women. And it's an interesting question, you know, why was that the case? And, you know, going back to the origins of at least the modern spiritualism movement, which kicked off in 1848 with the Fox sisters in Hydesville, New York. And these were two young girls, roughly 11 and 13, Maggie and Kate Fox. And they just created this whole sensation. And their older sister, Leia, who lived nearby in Rochester, heard what these girls were doing, and they were basically hearing these knockings and rappings and saying they were communicating with the spirit of a man who'd been murdered in their basement or buried in their basement. His name was Mr. Splitfoot. And the whole, they were literally like overnight sensations. The whole neighborhood was like flocking to their house to, you know, hear these communications with the dead. So Leia, about 20 years older, she caught wind of this. She'd been divorced, and being divorced as a woman at that time was not a good position to be in society. So she thought, wow, this is like a new job opportunity. You know, we're suddenly kind of running a movement here. we're communicators with the dead. That's a job that didn't really exist before. And she really ran with that. And they, you know, they began touring across Rochester and made a lot of money, went down to New York City, went across America and overseas to Europe, performed before royalty. So all of a sudden you have this new opening that women can take part in and really have a powerful position in as people who are communicating with the dead. And if that's what the dead are saying, you listen to what these women are saying. And what's amazing is how good they were at this. If they were genuine, then that's one thing. But if they weren't genuine, it's almost just as impressive that they could do these incredible manifestations. You know, table levitation, furniture moving, things appearing from nowhere, voices being heard. All of these things they were somehow learning on their own. They weren't like magicians who would have an apprenticeship and could learn from each other. They were figuring these things out and fooling a lot of scientific men, which is, I think, just the fascinating part of this whole history.
Yeah, nowadays, we've got like James Van Praagh, John Edward. A lot of men are mediums and good ones.
Yeah. I think now it's maybe a bit more balanced, but I think in terms of some of these earlier mediums, you know, Victorian era, it did seem to kind of skew more female.
Were there any mediums that stand out from the past that you would say were amazing?
Yeah, there were a few. I mean, I think someone like Leonora Piper, who, again, this was around the turn of the century, mm-hmm. and she would go into these trances, just kind of, you know, put her head down and start delivering messages, you know, that she's hearing from somewhere. And she...
Whoopi Goldberg.
Yeah, kind of like that, yeah. But she would say that she wouldn't exactly say that she was a spiritualist or that the voices were coming from the dead. She just said, I just hear these things, and I'm not saying where they're coming from because she didn't know. But she would give some fairly accurate information oftentimes. You know, it might be, in certain cases, news about a relative who was several states away. And keep in mind, several states away at that time was a huge gap. You know,
sure.
You could get messages until it could be a week till you could hear from someone through, you know, the mail or whatever. So she would give messages maybe about someone who passed away or had fallen ill, and the person who was getting that message at the seance would have no idea about this and would find out a week or two or whatever later that was in fact true. So that makes you wonder, okay, well, how was she getting this information? I mean, how would she have dug these things up on her own or in advance? It's pretty remarkable. On the other hand, she had some kind of, you know, weird, wacky things that she said also, but who knows? I mean, if they're spirits, maybe some of them are a bit mischievous. But I thought she was an interesting case.
Well, with Mark Hartzman, his new book is called Chasing Ghosts, which is available right now, isn't it?
Right now, yeah, wherever you buy books, online or at bookstores.
I noticed Amazon started taking orders a few weeks ago, so that's pretty good, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about Harry Houdini, the great mentalist and illusionist and escape artist. his mother passed, and he was obsessed with trying to find a proper medium to communicate with her, and ended up really debunking most of them, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he was really dead set against debunking them. And, you know, part of it was, yes, he would have loved to have contacted his mother, but he also, in his early years as a magician, he was holding seances and doing this as an act, basically.
Right.
You know, conjuring.
But it was a skit.
Yes, exactly. And then, you know, at some point he realized that he didn't like that. He didn't like the idea of it, you know, taking money from those who were grieving and making them think that they were having a genuine connection to someone on the other side when he knew, like, nope, I'm just doing a trick. So he thought that that was just, you know, kind of despicable. It was very different to him than a magic show. Like, if he was putting on his own show on a stage, people who pay to see that show, they know what they're getting into. They know they're paying for an act that a magician is putting on, and to be amazed by that versus truly believing that they're communicating with a lost loved one. So that was another thing that kind of drove him to expose these frauds, was just, I think, his own morals.
So was he out to convince himself or the world about these mediums?
I think a little bit of both. I mean, I think that he definitely wanted to prevent people from being duped.
Do you think he wanted to really find a real medium?
I think he would have loved to have found a real medium, only because I think, like I said earlier, he was open to the idea of this being possible. He just hadn't seen evidence of it. And, you know, he famously had made a pact with his wife that when he passed away, if he could come back, he would, and had given her, you know, a particular code word, which, of course, many mediums tried to reach him afterwards. Mm-hmm. And they did, but they did not. No one had that particular code word.
I ran a clip a couple of years ago of a seance with them trying to reach Houdini. And they gave it their best effort, but it didn't work. But the medium was, you know, just, Houdini, contact us, Houdini. And they tried.
Yeah. It's one of those things. I mean, you wish it worked, because it seemed like if someone was going to come back or find a way, you know, Houdini would have been a good candidate for that.
And with the title Chasing Ghosts, did you find some?
Well, one thing that I thought was really interesting in terms of finding some was how technology has been used to try to capture evidence. And in some cases, found ways that could really explain different paranormal experiences in a more scientific way. And that said, and people who came up with these different theories would acknowledge that that doesn't by any means explain everything, or is 100% explaining, you know, anything in that particular realm that they were explaining. But it could capture some, you know, supposed ghosts, which I thought was interesting. So I'll give you an example. One of them was a guy named Vic Tandy, who in the late 1970s, he was a scientist who was working in a large warehouse-type factory in England. And he had heard that this place had been haunted and that people saw different, you know, shadowy figures and heard noises and all these things. And he was working there late at night. And he, in addition to being, you know, in the science field, he also was a fencer. And he, coincidentally, had a tournament the next morning. So he brought his foil to work so he could, I guess, sharpen it and prepare it for his match. And he had stepped away from it and noted when he came back that it was wobbling, like that you know, the thin foil was moving. He thought, well, what's causing this? This is weird.
Looking for a breeze or something, huh?
Yeah, but there was no breeze. And I think he started seeing some of these, like, shadowy figures. And so he thought, well, something must be causing this. And he wasn't believing it was just a ghost, you know, shaking his foil or something. So he looked into it, and he discovered that this large, like, industrial fan that was just, I guess, you know, putting the air through this warehouse was creating infrasound.
Hold on for a second, Mark. We'll pick it up right there on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, as we talk about Chasing Ghosts with Mark Hartzman, we're going to take your calls. That'll be next hour here on Coast to Coast. Still lots more to talk with him about when we come back in just a moment. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you. Mark Hartzman with us. Mark, you were talking about the individual had a little piece of foil that seemed to be wavering. And tell me, he discovered a fan was on or something?
Yeah, he had his fencing foil. And it was wobbling back and forth, and he discovered this industrial fan that was, you know, just circulating the air within this warehouse was creating an infrasound, which is a frequency at 18.9 hertz that we don't hear, but we feel effects of without realizing it. So he found that this particular frequency that was present would cause things like a vibration in the eyeball, which could cause the sensation of seeing shadowy figures, you know, in your periphery. It also causes fear. It could cause cold sweats. It causes all these things that might lead you to think that you're seeing some kind of or having some kind of paranormal experience. So he took that and he said, "Oh, this is what was causing the movement of this foil, this frequency going through the area." So then he decided to take some instruments and kind of measure and search for infrasound in other places that were allegedly haunted. So a couple of examples. One is he went to a 14th century cellar of a cathedral in England that was reportedly haunted. People had all kinds of experiences in this basement. And sure enough, he found infrasound present there as well. And then he would take it to places like narrow hallways in various places, and he would find evidence of infrasound in these narrow hallways. So he's finding it in these places that are sort of tropes of haunted houses or haunted places, which was very interesting. Like, okay, here is maybe a way that he's captured a ghost. It just happens to be a frequency that we don't physically or consciously detect.
Interesting take. What about poltergeists? How do they compare to ghosts?
So poltergeists, I mean, I think most people think of poltergeists, you know, obviously the movie from the early 80s.
Right.
You think of these sort of, I mean, it means, you know, noisy ghost. It's sort of the translation of it. So you think of these sort of rambunctious ghosts throwing things around your home or whatever it might be. But again, in talking with different parapsychologists, they would define a poltergeist as something a little bit different and more of less of a ghost and more of something coming from within someone living. So I give a few different examples of stories in the book, but there are hundreds of cases of poltergeists over the centuries, which have been documented. But what's interesting is a lot of them seem to focus around teenagers. And so you find it like the theory is that somehow these, you know, whether it's going through puberty or some sort of emotions being built up within these teenagers are being released in what's called, you know, recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis. So through psychokinesis, they're moving things, you know, on their own. That's how this energy is kind of coming out of them, whatever sort of pent up inside them, which is an interesting theory.
Sure.
There's a lot of interesting cases where you know, these things are happening. So like the Enfield case in you know, northern London, a famous case from the late 70s, early 80s, where these young girls were having all kinds of effects happening at their house. And they were going through puberty. Their father had left recently, so they were kind of having a traumatic time in their life. And, you know, they have furniture flying. There's voices coming out of, you know, a voice of an old man who said he was died there, like, you know, 80 years earlier or something. So there's all these weird effects happening, and people are testifying to this. Policemen who are investigating say that they're seeing furniture zipping around rooms, and they're looking for evidence of how it's moving, and they're finding no strings, nothing to have faked it. So you have this case of lots of regular people seeing these effects happening in this house that seem to be emanating from these young, primarily one of the girls who was around 12 years old. So yeah, it's definitely an interesting case whether what they call RSPK is what's responsible for poltergeist.
Have you been to many haunted places, and what would you say is the most haunted you've seen?
I visited quite a few, the best I could. You know, research was happening a lot during COVID, so it made it a little bit difficult
Sure. To
do as much as I wanted. But I did get to go to quite a few places. And one place I would say that I thought was especially, you know, creepy and certainly a good candidate for hauntings was the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum in West Virginia. And this place just has that history, you know, that just feels like, yeah, if you passed away here, you might haunt this place, especially if you're trapped there, you're not going to be a happy spirit. Just all sorts of, you know, horrific things happen at this asylum. You know, all these kinds of terrible medical treatments that they thought were good, but were not, you know, electroshock therapy, you know, the
they were
cold
cruel,
bath.
Weren't they?
Very cruel, yeah. And one of the worst, I think, was the lobotomy. the transorbital lobotomy that Walter Freeman was doing, and he was doing, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of these in West Virginia and primarily at this asylum. And that's where he took the ice pick, just the ice pick right out of his kitchen drawer, and would tap it with a hammer through your eyeball, you know, up above through your eye socket, and twist it a little bit and pull out that portion of the brain for the lobotomy. It's just doing it like it was nothing. To tons of people.
You'd go blind if it didn't kill you.
Yeah, people did not necessarily do well after that. There were many issues.
Jeez.
And this went on for quite a while. He had a whole truck. He traveled the country and called the lobotomobile. So, I mean, he's a whole crazy story. So you have all these crazy instances that were going on at this asylum. And there are lots of reportings of patients having seen ghosts when they were there. And then, of course, it closed down, I think in the 80s or 90s. It was reopened within the past, I'm forgetting exactly, maybe 10, 15, 20 years. But now it's, you know, now it's a place for touring. And so they have lots of paranormal tours, ghost tours, and people have had lots of experiences. I spoke with one woman who leads tours who's had all sorts of really interesting experiences there, things where, you know, she'll have markings appear on her arm and her back out of nowhere and, you know, burning and leaving evidence, you know, and there was nothing physically causing that anyone could see. And she's with people who would attest to this. So things like that are really odd and unusual. She gave me another example of trying to capture an EVP, you know, electronic voice phenomena, but using what's called, and I discuss this in the book, called the Estes method, which was developed by a few paranormal investigators from Estes Park, Colorado, who worked at the Stanley Hotel, which of course is where Stephen King was inspired to write The Shining, and is also known to be a haunted place. And so what they would do is, rather than try to capture a voice recording and then listen to it, you know, or listen to a recording and listen for a voice, in which case sometimes you might think you hear something and then everyone agrees, like, oh, yeah, I hear that too. And it's called apophenia, which is, it's like pareidolia, where your mind kind of recognizes patterns or tries to make sense of patterns by something with something you recognize, right? So you might think that you're hearing something, even though maybe that's not really what it is. So to avoid that effect and that groupthink effect, they would have one person listen through headphones and have a blindfold on, so like, you know, creating sensory deprivation in one room, and then on the other side, another room, you'd have someone asking the questions with the recording device. So then as soon as the person with the headphones was on was hearing something, they would shout out what they're hearing, and then they would match up with the questioner and see what the question was asked and what answer was given and compare those. And oftentimes there's some pretty crazy effects. So the example I got from the woman at the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum, she said that she shouted the word evil, and then her friend who was asking the question said, we have to get out of here, let's go. They ran out, and she said, what's the problem? What was the question you asked? And she said, this woman who was questioning said that she'd seen someone walking in the hallway and said, is that person in the hallway nice? And the answer was evil. So they got a little freaked out by that. But again, it's like they didn't know the question, the answer came. And it's eerie how it can kind of match up.
Have you ever had a situation where somebody tried to prove about the existence of the other side and did themselves in so they could probably come back?
Yes. So there's a really interesting case in 1921. There was a man named Thomas Bradford who was a student of spiritualism. And he so believed that communication was possible from the other side that he set out to prove it by committing suicide.
Oh my gosh.
So the way he conducted this experiment was he first put an ad in a newspaper to find a partner for this project, someone that he could connect with and have a real bond with so he could reach out to that person up from the other side, kind of like an early Craigslist ad, you know, that
kind
of thing. So a woman responded. And she didn't really know what she was getting into. I think she just kind of thought this was like a psychological experiment, which she was interested in. And so they met, they had discussions, talked about the whole thing. But she didn't realize he was actually going to kill himself, which he did. And he left behind a very long note, you know, or booklet, I guess you could say, about what he was doing and what he planned to do and how he would communicate.
And he wasn't depressed or anything. He killed himself for the sole intent of proving the afterlife, right?
Exactly. Yes, Yeah, that was the whole thing. Was like, it's going to be okay because I'm going to live on, so it's fine. That was his state of mind, and so he planned. You know, she went ahead and had the seance to receive the message that he said he would deliver, and she claimed to have gotten a message from him at the seance. So, you know, again, take from that what you will. I don't think he was heard from again after that. And I think the good news from the story is that no one imitated him, at least not that I found in my research. I didn't find any imitators who said, oh, that's great. Let's go, you know, do the same thing. That was a pretty interesting and unique case.
How did you start out researching the Chasing Ghosts book?
Well, for me, it started with my interest in spiritualism, which, you know, I talked about a little bit earlier and just now, of course. But I really found that to be the topic that I've been researching for the past few years and buying a lot of books on them from the late 1800s, just because I found the topic fascinating. And I love these books that had all these stories in them and these amazing occurrences. And I love the fact that people really believed that this was possible back then and were convinced that this was the case. It's in a way, I guess this kind of came from the same fascination I had with my previous book, The Big Book of Mars. At the same time, people were believing that we could communicate with Martians and that they were intelligent Martians. And I keep thinking, like, what a time to be alive this was, when we were sure that there were Martians we could talk to and we were sure that there were dead people we could talk to. So this whole time period just really fascinated me with what people were thinking and believing. So I really just kind of got into all these stories of the different mediums and the effects they were producing and the culture around it all.
Has technology helped what you do?
Oh, in terms of research? Absolutely.
In which ways?
I mean, just the information I'm able to pull out, you know, now. I mean, I think back, it's funny, you know, you had mentioned my other books. When I wrote American Sideshow, that book came out in 2005, and I thought I had it good with technology then. But I realize now, like, oh, I could have uncovered so much more and found so many more people to connect with, you know, living relatives of performers, that sort of thing. So for this book, certainly in terms of research with the different newspaper archives that are available, different, you know, archiving systems where you can just dig up all these great articles. I mean, I love how often ghosts were big headlines in the newspapers. You know, this was often big news. You don't see that anymore. You know, it's kind of a rarity now, but this was these were common stories back then. So I love just kind of digging up these interesting stories about the well-known mediums and the more obscure ones as well. So that's been helpful. And then the same thing, just in terms of contacting people who are either, you know, historians, researchers, parapsychologists, paranormal investigators, and relatives. So it makes all these things easier and lets me dig a little bit deeper into the subject.
Years ago, we posted some video on our website, Mark, of a car that was being towed to a lot after it had been totaled, and somebody died in that accident. And so you see the grainy, because it's nighttime, you see the grainy green-looking video of the tow truck bringing this smacked-up car into this lot where all these dead cars are. And it drops it off and takes off. And then all of a sudden you see a body get out of that smashed car, walking around the lot, and it kind of disappears. It had to have been the dead person. It's weird.
That is weird. It sounds like a lost spirit. You know, that
just wandering around.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting aspect that I talked about a bit in the book too, is just sometimes the dead might not know they're dead, you know. And in ancient times, cultures had shamans, you know, and psychopomps who would help the dead, you know, find their way to the afterlife. That was the role of the psychopomp.
There was even a couple books about that, like the Tibetan Book of the Dead, Egyptian Book of the Dead, almost like a guide to what happens when you die.
The Book of the Dead would guide you through the underworld, right? That was your guide book to how to get to eternal paradise and to get through the different trials and tribulations on the way. So I discussed that as well. But this idea of the psychopomp is really interesting, and it faded away. People stopped believing in that. But people still see ghosts, and maybe that's a service that we've lost in culture that could be useful again for the dead. And maybe, you know, something like you were just describing is a spirit that either didn't know it was dead or didn't know what to do and was sort of lost without any help. Again, all just interesting theories and possibilities.
We're going to take calls with Mark Hartzman next hour here on Coast to Coast, and that would include your stories or your questions about Ghosts, his latest book that just came out today, Chasing Ghosts. Mark, I want to talk with you when we come back a little bit about the book you wrote on eBay. What possessed you to write that? It was amazing, by the way.
Thanks. That was a lot of fun. That kind of started, again, from my love for the unusual, where I was buying cabinet cards of sideshow performers from the late 1800s and thought, is this weird that I'm buying these photos of these, you know, strange performers? And I thought, no, I love this. But there's probably a lot of stuff out there that everyone would think is objectively just weird. Like, this is just a bizarre thing to sell. So I started researching different, truly, what I thought were truly weird things and finding a ton of them, and then also writing letters to the sellers asking them equally weird questions to see what they would come back to me with. And, of course, they always had a great answer to try to make the sale, which was really fun.
All right, let's come back and talk a little bit more about that, and then we'll take some calls next hour here on Coast to Coast AM. Our special guest, Mark Hartzman, Chasing Ghosts. Websites are all linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Also, don't forget our YouTube channel. It's free to subscribe. Just go to YouTube, type in Coast to Coast AM Official.